Oliver is an English musical that premiered on the West End in 1960 and on Broadway in 1962. Based on the Charles Dickens novel, Oliver Twist, it's enjoyed massive success in both the stage version and in the beloved 1968 movie adaptation. It was not planned that we would cover both Annie and Oliver this season, but when it did happen, I of course could not resist putting those episodes back to back, because they are both, of course, about adorable orphan children. In this orphan tale, Oliver lives in a workhouse, but is thrown out when he dares ask for more gruel, after which he accidentally falls in with a group of young pickpockets led by the elderly Fagin. Hijinks ensue thereafter, during which he is helped out by a woman named Nancy, as they both try to stay safe from Fagin's criminal schemes and from Nancy's abusive husband, Bill Sykes. My guest today is Colin Cominger, an actor and singer who completely missed his chance to star in Oliver as a child. I hope you enjoy our conversation about Oliver. Hi, Colin. How are you doing?
I'm good, Quinn. I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. What are we talking about today?
Well, today we're going to talk about the musical Oliver! Which is a Lionel Bart musical that is adapted from Oliver Twist by Charles Dickens.
I literally cannot go further. I just have to share with the audience that Colin came to me with two different musicals, and I thought I said, let's do Oliver, and apparently I said, let's do the other one.
She said the other one, but that's okay. I'm going to adapt as best I can.
That's why you're a star.
Yeah, I've seen Oliver and read Oliver enough that I think I can roll with the punches here.
It was just this is how we do the podcast now. It's a surprise what you talk about when you walk into the studio. But with that, why did you put Oliver on your shortlist?
I think Oliver is, I love Victorian literature. And Dickens, of course, is sort of the king of the mid-Victorian era. And Oliver Twist is one of his most popular works. And this is an amazing adaptation of Oliver Twist. Like, it really does hit all the high points. So as an adaptation of literature, it's fantastic. And as a musical, it's extraordinary. Not just in the music itself, which is quite good, but also when you learn more about it and you learn how it was composed and everything, it just blows my mind.
So when did you first experience this musical?
I probably saw it in middle school or something. I'm sure there was a time in choir class where my teacher put it on, the movie version. And that was really great. And as I got more into reading, because I studied English in college, that became more significant. So especially adaptations of literature became much more prominent in my life. My freshman orientation class was about adaptation. And then as I continued in my English degree, I did a class about specifically adaptations of Victorian literature to film. And Oliver Twist has many, many film adaptations, of which the musical is but one.
I love when people have an academic interest in these kinds of things.
Yeah. It's definitely one of my primary things that I like to learn about, and being a musical theater actor as well. Like, it's fun to combine those interests into one thing.
Have you ever been in a production of Oliver?
No, I haven't. And I sort of missed the boat in middle school, because I do remember them doing it at some point when I was still young. And I missed the boat on being like a kid in Oliver. And after that, the only opportunity I would have to be in it now until I become quite old would be to be Bill Sykes. But aside from that, no, I'll have to hang on for another 40 years until I can play Fagin.
Well, you know, that's something to look forward to.
Yeah, my career will not end when I'm 60. It's just beginning.
So I was aware that this musical existed. I thought I hadn't heard anything from it. And then I started listening to it, and I was like, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I know these songs.
Yeah.
Or at least, like, the big ones. They're Food, Glorious Food.
Yeah.
Consider Yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not even sure if I had heard that I Would Do Anything, but it was pretty.
It's a beautiful song. All Nancy's songs are just fantastic in this musical.
Oh, man. I want to talk about Nancy for a good long time, but not immediately.
Okay. Put a pin in that one.
I have so many thoughts. But I start with just essentially one,
I love that the title has an exclamation point in it.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea why? Because that's wild to me.
I don't know why. I'm sure there is a reason. I didn't come across it in my research or experience, why they didn't want to call it Oliver Twist. I assume it was something to do with the 60s vogue for sort of shortening things and making them punchier. And it wasn't Oliver Twist per se. It was just Oliver.
Oliver. It's not a very happy story, so it's so excited of a title.
Well, and they say it many times throughout the show. That becomes the sort of thing where it's Oliver, Oliver. Yeah. That name becomes emblematic. And the name the main character becomes the linchpin of all these stories, from the orphanage to London. The focus of the show is Oliver. So,
if there's anything musical theater loves, it's stories about little orphan children. Why is this a thing?
In the Victorian era, when Dickens was writing, I feel that became an established trope because it was so much more dangerous to have children. It was much more common to have a child with especially no mother, but definitely no parents at all, because you might die of various diseases for which they had not yet developed vaccines. You might die because of accidents in factories or it was a dangerous world before OSHA and before modern medicine, and people died a lot. So you had a lot of cases of orphans who were living with other relatives or who lived, in the case of Oliver, in a workhouse.
And then you have him hanging out with Eponine. Well, I guess Eponine wasn't technically an orphan, but...
No, her dad was Thénardier, but...
Like, who was better off, really?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, technically... if I'm remembering the story correctly, in the book, Gavroche is also Thénardier's child. Maybe that's super wrong. Don't quote me on that.
No, I think that rings true. That rings a bell.
Okay. So you also had people like that who were essentially orphans because their parents were just so neglectful because there were no laws about child abuse yet.
It's not a good time to be a person.
No.
Well, unless you're rich. It was a great time to be very wealthy.
Isn't it always?
It's never a bad time to be very wealthy. But with going along with musical theater, just really loving orphan children, this musical was wildly successful.
Oh, gosh.
I had no idea how ridiculously successful Oliver was, or is, I guess.
Yeah, because I think there's a revival running right now, if I'm not mistaken, in London. To one of those shows like Phantom of the Opera, like Fiddler on the Roof, that has run for so long that it's almost just a staple of the Broadway and the West End scene.
Yeah, there was an Oliver revival on the West End in 2017.
Quite recent.
It is just always around. One of the notes that I came across was that it was extremely successful, especially when it first premiered in 1960. And in the 1970s, it was, quote unquote, by far the most produced school musical in England.
Well, and it has several things to recommend it for that, namely that you have a bunch of little kids in it. And my director in high school had the habit of inserting little children into shows even where they could not possibly have gone. When I was a freshman, I was in My Fair Lady, and we had a children's chorus in My Fair Lady who just came on and sang reprises of songs that had just been sung by the main characters.
But why?
Because when you're running a school theater program and you need to put butts in seats, all the little kids' parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles are going to come. That tapers off as a child gets older because it's not as cute, I guess, or it's not as significant. But if it's, little Tammy's first time being on the stage and being in a show, everybody shows up for that.
I always have questions about, I hear stories about my friends, like musical theater adaptations in their elementary, middle school, high schools. It's like, why didn't your director just do a different show?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I experienced that. I used to do shows at a Catholic girls' school because they needed men to do the men's parts. And I remember them doing Les Miserables, and because it was a Catholic school, it had to be heavily censored in some parts. So lines like bargain prices up against a wall became bargain prices winter, spring, or fall. And other
like
such,
a Macy's.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It's a blowout sale, biannual Victoria's Secret. Yeah, but that was essentially the kind of thing that we were dealing with. Oliver, surprisingly clean, despite the fact that Nancy is a prostitute and Bill Sykes is an abusive psychopath. But Dickens set out when he wrote the story to portray lower class life in a way that would not offend upper class people. That was kind of his specialty. And he was a big social justice progressive in that way.
Yeah. I never read Oliver in my like high school reading list or whatnot. Mm-hmm. We did read Great Expectations, which is a wild ride. And so as I was researching Oliver and reading about it, first of all, there are so many characters, and it really goes around the bend. But as it was getting towards the end of it, and I was like, yeah, even just with the one Dickens novel that I've read, you can already start to see the patterns.
Yes, his novels follow pretty predictable kinds of patterns. You know, there's an orphan boy and his circumstances change. In Oliver's case, the circumstances get a little bit worse before they get better, but ultimately they get better. Very often there's a young woman with whom he has some kind of, even though he's younger than her, has some kind of romantic interest.
It's very Star Wars Episode One.
Yeah. Are you an angel? but that's a biographical thing from Dickens' life. He had, I believe, a cousin who was a female cousin who he very much admired and loved. And I don't know the degree of closeness in terms of familial relationships, but it wasn't uncommon in those days to meet distant family members and become romantically involved with them because they didn't have Tinder in the Victorian era.
Yes, they didn't know about DNA.
They didn't know yet.
A lot of gaps there.
Yeah. So that was something that had actually happened to Dickens, and you have these characters in his books who are very beatific, very good, pure young women characters, and about 60% of the time they end up dying off by the end of the book.
I've really already lived past my life expectancy according to the Victorian novels, so true. I'm really killing it.
Yeah.
I'm 22 years old and I haven't died in childbirth yet, so.
You have no black lung. You don't work in a factory. You're living large according to Victorian standards.
They would be amazed by my life and health. As I'm currently ill, but only with a cold. I'm not going to get the plague or anything.
You won't die of it. I can't count the number of Victorian characters who caught a chill and then passed away unceremoniously.
Or spontaneously combusted. Those are the best
ones. That's true.
Another quick note about just the sort of overall popularity of Oliver is about the film, which I find this incredibly charming in that the film was also a huge success, is still extremely beloved, especially by the British public, and also won a ton of Academy Awards, including one for choreography, because choreography is not an Oscar, but they were like, it was so good. Here's a special Academy Award.
The scale of the movie Oliver is absolutely impressive to this day. This was an era, obviously, before digital compositing, where you could create background characters who looked essentially photorealistic. I mean, there's limitations on software, but essentially creating crowds and crowds of people who looked real in the background, this was not possible. So they had real crowds of people in all these scenes. One of my favorite group numbers or ensemble numbers in the musical is Who Will Buy. It's this massive scene that shows like a panoply of Victorian society. You have the milkmaids who start the number. You have the Flower Girls. Flower Girls will make a return in My Fair Lady. You have schoolmasters and schoolmistresses who are guiding children around, painters, cobblers, like dustmen. Any kind of like feature of Victorian society are represented. Bobbies with their police helmets are represented in this dance number, and it's massive. And my favorite part of it is they get to the end of the song, and it goes through the who will buy, who will buy, who will buy, who will buy, and then the camera, which has pulled out to take in the entire square and all the massive crowd that inhabits it, zooms in on Bill Sykes and the Artful Dodger looking around like, what the hell is happening here? Like, is this how rich people live? But yeah, if you've never seen the movie or if you haven't seen it for a while, I absolutely recommend just looking up that scene to see the camera zoom in on their incredulous faces in the middle of this dance.
That's a very kind of The Office cut.
Oh, it was very much like a gym face to the camera almost.
That's beautiful. I love how when you get those glimpses of how a human humor really hasn't changed in the past 100 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a very funny show. And the choreography, by and large, it was absolutely extraordinary. I'm not on the Oscar board, so I don't know about the process for creating special Oscars all the time. But it's absolutely a wonderful film. And you have to keep in mind that it's gone now through two layers of adaptation. It's gone through the adaptation of the book to the musical and then the musical to film. So there are things that the film could do that the musical on stage probably can't. And part of it is having this cast of hundreds and hundreds of people all dancing and editing that together. Like that is an extraordinary achievement.
Mm-hmm. Although I will say, obviously, they couldn't do it to this scale, but it does seem like Oliver is a very large cast of a musical.
You can't get around how big of a cast it is because you've got, to start off with, Oliver and all his kids in the workhouse. Now, you're going to use those same kids to play the pickpockets later, but even so, like, you've got that huge number in the workhouse and the governors and the quartermaster of the workhouse itself, Mr. Bumble. And then you've got the whole series with the Undertaker and the Undertaker's apprentice and his wife. And then you go to London and you've got the pickpockets. You've got Fagin, you've got Bill Sykes, you've got Nancy, and Nancy's got a friend. And then you have the gentleman that takes Oliver in, and then you have the entire cast who needs to make up the crowds, because even if you can't get the crowds as big as in the movie, you still need crowds. So yeah, you're absolutely right that this is, no matter how you slice it, going to be a gigantic cast for a musical. There's no way around that.
I was watching promo reels for some of the more recent productions, and I was like, why are there 50 children on the stage? I've never seen that many small children on one stage.
I worked on a show about a year ago that was it involved children. It was about a high school, and there were, I think, 13 or 14 people below the age of 18 in that, and again, high school age, so relatively mature as children go. I can't imagine the amount of logistical skill needed to teach, rehearse, and wrangle 50-plus children, even at a modest size. Like, even if you cut it down to 30, like, that must be such a feat. And I wonder if there's people who just specialize in doing that for Oliver casts. Like, okay, one got over, time to go on to the next Oliver.
Because it's like, if there's like, let's say there's 20 kids on stage, which is an enormous number of children.
That's quite a lot of people, not to mention children.
Yeah, but then for every person you have on stage, you probably have two more actors, because if they're like 12 years old, you can't have the same person on every night. So you have to have two to three people per part.
Yeah.
There's got to be some people in the crew that are just children wranglers.
Yes, there are. I happen to know that there, for our crew of 15 children, there were two. I imagine there have to be a lot more. Although I will say that child performance laws, I mean, obviously they vary by area, but it boils down to the number of hours they're needed per day. If they can, manage it so that you only have to have the kids there for certain hours, or their call time is earlier or something like that, or they get released earlier. Usually you don't need doubles. You don't need to be like Hollywood where people are going to be there all day and you need Mary-Kate and Ashley to play the part. You can usually get away with that.
Okay. Yeah, I guess because it depends on the part as well, because maybe for like the because I know there have been plenty of children's parts that are like quite intensive where you have to have multiple parts, but maybe it's like a chorus of kids, so that wouldn't
and that is true of children who play Oliver and the Artful Dodger in this show. You definitely have to double cast those.
So many Dodgers running around.
Some of them artful, some of them not so much.
Speaking of the Artful Dodger, were you aware that there was a sequel written to this?
An Oliver sequel?
Yes.
To the musical or to the book?
To the musical.
No.
I couldn't really learn a lot about this.
Uh-huh.
It seemed like it was written quite recently. And this is just the blurb that was on the Wikipedia page that I'm going to read to you word for word right now.
Okay.
Dodger, a sequel written to Lionel Bart's Oliver, was composed by Andrew Fletcher with a book and lyrics written by David Lambert. It is set 7 years after the events in the novel Oliver Twist by Charles Dickens, where the Artful Dodger has been sentenced to an Australian penal colony and has a romantic involvement with the character Bet.
Wow. Okay.
What?
Well, there's an interesting difference between the book and the musical Oliver. In the book, most of the children get away scot-free. But Fagin, as the leader of this band of thieves, is taken to prison and presumably hanged afterward, which is pretty yikes. I guess you should not organize a band of child thieves, but it still seems pretty harsh. And in the musical, Fagin and the Artful Dodger, like, run away together because they both sort of realize, like, I can't change who I am. Fagin in particular has a song, I'm Reviewing the Situation. Great song. Where he contemplates going straight. He contemplates getting a wife. He contemplates getting a job, and each verse is a new thing that he's like, well, I'll just settle down, and then he talks himself out of it.
I'm reviewing that situation. I must quickly look up everyone I know. Titled people with a station who can help me make a real impressive show. I will.
Then Dodger shows up and is like, well, let's... You and me, like, let's go into business together. And Fagin's like, all right, sounds cool.
Sounds good,
yeah,
child.
Well, and you get the sense that Fagin, throughout the musical, has had this sort of faux paternal relationship with Oliver because, of course, Oliver, in true Dickens fashion, will not allow the world to corrupt him. He's too pure. He's too good for it, which is why the only reason he gets found out and eventually saved is because Dodger sets him up and plants the handkerchief and wallet that he was going to steal on Oliver. Oliver, of course, had no part in the actual thievery.
Oliver would never.
He would not. He's a good boy. So I think we can extrapolate that, though, to the idea that Fagin has a paternal relationship with all these children. Now, I mean, you can read into that as much as you want. Famously, there was a BBC adaptation of Oliver, a miniseries adaptation, where Timothy Spall, who I'm sure audience will recognize from the Harry Potter movies as Wormtail, where Timothy Spall played Fagin, and it was heavily implied that his interest in these children was not just as child thieves, but as sexual objects, that Fagin was a pedophile in this adaptation. I strongly prefer a much more cheery, paternalistic relationship, and I actually think in the musical, there's no shades of that. Fagin is quite sweet, and as brusque as he can be when, you know, the kids are complaining and he's like, go shut up and drink your gin! As brusque as he can be in those situations, his relationship with Oliver and then with Dodger does seem more like a father-son kind of relationship. And as precocious as Dodger is, you can see it from Dodger's perspective being kind of like, oh, we're partners now. And Fagin's content to like sort of indulge that. He's content to indulge that idea from Dodger. And takes care of Dodger in his way. So I could see there being more things after the musical ends. This sounds like a very interesting concept for a sequel. I wonder what happened to Fagin in this sequel, if it is indeed a sequel to the musical rather than to the books.
Yeah, the one production that I could find listed of it had good reviews, so I really don't know much about it, but it seemed like it was good family fun fare, which is incredibly funny considering, again, the subject matter of it being about a guy who goes to prison in Australia. But, you know, Dickens. Although I do believe that this had absolutely nothing to do with Dickens and was just
pretty much pure speculation at that point.
Yeah. Just like, because I'm sure that tons of people went to see Oliver and they were like, that's an interesting character. What would happen to him next? And so it was only a matter of time before someone.
Oh, yeah. I absolutely think Dodger is one of the most interesting characters. And there are other works of fiction where he appears as a side character. One that I can think of off the top of my head is the graphic novels The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen by Alan Moore. They start in the Victorian era in, I believe, the 1890s. And Dodger, a more adult Dodger, does make a background appearance in those graphic novels.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, even just the phrase, the Artful Dodger, like I'm sure a lot of people would recognize that, mm-hmm. even if they had no idea where the name of the character came from initially. Because it's, first of all, just a very good name. It's incredibly catchy.
Yeah.
And I think it's really permeated pop culture, even if like it's become somewhat disconnected from its source material even.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's an evocative, wonderful name. And if you go and you look up slang, like Victorian slang from the period, it's a beautiful, colorful, interesting lexicon. So a reader, or not readers, this is a podcast, listeners, if you feel compelled, do look up some Victorian slang sometime because there's some absolutely hilarious slang.
I don't know that much about Victorian slang, but you sound like every English major I've ever talked to.
Hey, that degree's paying for itself.
So we've talked a lot about this musical sort of in context, and I want to come back to more like plot-based slash character stuff in a moment, mm-hmm. but we haven't really talked about the music at all.
The music is fantastic, and it's made all the more extraordinary by the fact that Lionel Bart could not write and that he could not notate music.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Lionel Bart, when he was very young, according to Wikipedia, so if somebody like pulled my leg on this one, listeners, get mad at Quinn because she let me on this podcast. But when he was young, he was told by a violin teacher that he was like a musical genius. And this guy told his parents, like, your kid's going to be a prodigy. I think that kind of ruined him because he wasn't like a very good music student. But he went on to be not only a great composer for musical theater, but also a pop composer. Throughout the 60s, 70s, and I think early 80s, Lionel Bart continued to have pop songs he wrote that would chart. And what he did was he would make up the lyrics and like hum a melody or sing a melody for a friend who could orchestrate and notate, and that person would just write it all out for him.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful collaboration, honestly.
It's kind of the collaboration I wish I had.
That is great, because you hear all the time about partnerships where it's like one person writes music, one person writes lyrics. So it's like, what if one person's the creative mind and the other person knows how to actually do it?
The technical mind?
Yeah.
I think that is an underappreciated partnership. And I think Lionel Bart, I can't remember if he wrote the book for this musical.
He's listed as, he's credited as book writer.
He's a book writer? Okay. So he did, wow, not only the music and lyrics, but also the adaptation for it, which is a huge feat. I don't want to keep circling back to that because we're talking about the music. But the music itself, such earworms in this musical. Like you said earlier, Quinn, if you think you haven't heard music from this, you still probably have.
Since I started listening to the soundtrack, the entire background of my brain has been the one phrase, consider yourself, over and over.
Yep,
just those
yep.
two words ever.
It's clear we're going to get along. Consider yourself.
Willing?
Consider yourself. Part of the furniture. There isn't a lot to spare. Who cares what?
Yeah, that one is one of the more obnoxious earworms in it, although it's very hard to choose between them in terms of catchiness. I'd Do Anything's very catchy. Oom-pa-pa, very catchy.
I thought you were about to say mm-bop.
Mm-bop, very catchy. Bet you didn't know it's from Oliver.
And then there's Food, Glorious Food.
Food, Glorious Food,
which is basically
the,
yeah, Food, Glorious Food is the starting song. Mm-hmm. It's just these orphans singing about the food they wish they were eating, which is very sad. But it's somehow both like kind of a slow, sad song and also just like you could play it next to Be Our Guest from
Beauty
and the Beast, and they would kind of go together.
Yes, different time signatures, but very much thematically and even somewhat musically linked. They've both got a little bit of that bounce, especially when it changes from the first couple lines of Food, Glorious Food to the actual like choruses of it. Yeah, really, definitely related.
I'm sure I've talked about this on the podcast before, but my knowledge of these songs comes from the 5-disc CD set I have that was like best of the musicals, and it had all of these songs on it, and included were Food, Glorious Food and Consider Yourself from Oliver, and so that's where I had previously heard them alongside all the classics from, you know, My Fair Lady and The Lion King and all
Les Mis, Miss Saigon, like all those.
All the classics.
Yeah, that CD set available in a thrift store near you, listener.
So that, of course, sort of solidifies in my mind that it is, in fact, part of musical theater canon.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, there's the song As Long As He Needs Me, which I feel like I must have heard before, but I didn't fully recognize when I listened to it.
It's a popular song. It's a popular song for altos or mezzo-sopranos to do. So if you were ever in a voice studio class or anything like that, you will probably have heard it or have done it yourself.
Justice for altos.
Yeah.
As long as he needs me.
And with that, I kind of want to bring this around to the conversation I've been dying to have, which is about the character of Nancy.
Oh, boy. Okay.
I Well, do you want to start in giving sort of a basic rundown of Nancy?
Sure. Okay. So Nancy is a confederate of Fagin, and she's with Bill Sykes, who will not marry her. It doesn't come right out and say it, but she's clearly like a prostitute. And she is one of the people that Oliver meets in true Dickens fashion, where the world is sort of divided into horrible villains who make your life terrible and beautiful angels who love you. And Nancy is the beautiful angel, despite being a prostitute. And despite, you know, I mean, I will say that dichotomy is complicated somewhat for many Dickens characters. But she's basically sort of the person who recognizes that Oliver is too pure for this horrible underworld that they live in.
It's the hooker with a heart of gold.
Yes, exactly. That trope to a T. And she is in this horrible, abusive relationship with Bill Sykes, about whom she sings "As Long as He Needs Me." That's about Bill, because she can't leave this relationship. Now, that's not to say she doesn't resist. There's a great scene where they're basically planning on getting Oliver back from the rich gentleman who has adopted him. And then ransoming him off or something like that. And they need Nancy to do it. That's sort of the last act of defiance that she has, the last moral quandary that Nancy as a character faces in this show. And Bill goes, "Oh, she'll do it, Fagin." And Nancy says, "No, she won't, Fagin." And Bill goes, "Yes, she will, Fagin." And that's sort of just symbolic of their relationship as a whole. Nancy tries to do good, and she tries to resist Bill, who is, as I have said before, psychotic. But she does it, finally. And spoilers, listeners, this is where we're going to get into the spoiler part of the podcast.
Spoiler horde.
Yeah. She does it at the cost of her own life. Ultimately, Bill finds out about her plot to return Oliver to the rich man who's adopted him and murders her. And this is – then there's a whole crowd scene where Bill Sykes himself dies. But that's sort of – she's paid back – for doing good with dying, which sucks.
This following is just horrible in so many ways. In one, there's just the level of, like, that this is basically the only female character in the show.
Essentially, yeah.
There are a few others, but
the only good female character, certainly.
For sure, yeah. And it's like, it's so, I mean, I'm not going to nail Oliver to a wall for this, considering it was written in the 1830s. This musical was adapted
right.
The 60s. Like, it is what it is. But it also, it's just unfortunate, and I can't let that go uncommented upon. But it's also just in context of the musical and this being like a very child-friendly, child-centered yeah. thing, that one of the major plot lines is that one of the characters is an abused woman who's eventually murdered by her boyfriend. What?
I think this was one of Dickens' attempts to sort of portray the hideousness of London underground society at the time. That, first of all, that prostitutes or disreputable women could still be good people, which, you know, for, like you said, I think it was published 1850s, but that was sort of a major kind of stance to take and to show that even though there were good people among these, that they often met bad ends because there were so many bad people or bad circumstances among the lower class at the time.
Yeah, this is I more don't fault Dickens for the inclusion of this because I think it makes a lot of sense mm-hmm. in context of the original book as well as sort of Dickens' entire catalog. And he was writing about very adult themes even when it did center around children. It's more the question of the choice to adapt this as a children's musical with the inclusion of this. And I'm like, this was a bold choice is all I'm going to say.
That's true. I think as a child, this is probably one of those things that goes over your head. You can definitely sense that Bill doesn't treat Nancy well and he's a mean, mean man. And I don't think it escapes even children that Nancy gets murdered. But it's not generally shown on stage. That would be pretty graphic.
In the middle school productions.
Oh, boy, just that long, long strangulation scene mm-hmm. with Lionel Bart's underscore going, ba-ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba. That would be
so
horrible.
So many calls to the principal.
That would be horrible, yeah. So I don't think that escapes children. But again, I also don't think – when you say a children's musical, it's a musical with children in it, and it's sort of a family musical in that there's no – sex, there's no swearing, it's not Spring Awakening or Dirty Rotten Scoundrels or any of those that would be like more adult. But it does still tackle mature themes. Let me ask you, Quinn, would you, taking the whole idea of this musical in and its history and whatnot, would you rather have left that out or would you rather have changed it so that Nancy has an end that rewards her for doing the morally right thing? Or are you sort of okay with this being included? I don't want it to get too personal, but like, how do you feel about it being included in what is ostensibly a family musical?
Yeah, that's a really complicated question. 'Cause I think this also goes back to like that this musical was written so long ago. And I this struck me especially because I was looking at a page that ranked it as rated PG according yeah. to movie standards, which sounds about right, even in terms of like how graphic it is and the subject matter. I just find it very interesting that if you just like took the events of the story and just lay them on a piece of paper and you're like, I'm going to make a gritty R-rated adaptation of this, that would be very easy to do. And so that's sort of the tension in this, I think. And so I don't necessarily think that it would be right to adapt this book and sanitize it like mm-hmm. that and take out the more difficult parts. And I almost wish that it was done more in a PG-13 adaptation instead.
Yeah, maybe take that on even a little more seriously.
Yeah, and sort of make it more like I think that I would explore taking the tact of like instead of making it more of a family musical, making it more like this, the center of this story is younger, but that doesn't mean that it's not like more of a teenage subject matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people fall into the trap of thinking that just because the main character is a child, that it's for children. And I think we've all encountered a TV show or read a book or seen a movie where they're like, oh, it's about kids. It's like, you know, Stand By Me or Stranger Things or any of those things that are like in the grand tradition of 80s coming of age things mm-hmm. Where, yes, it's about children, but it's not for children necessarily or it's not primarily for children.
Mm-hmm. I mean, The Exorcist was about a child. So yeah. I still haven't even seen The Exorcist.
I show my young nieces and nephews The Exorcist. They loved it. They stayed up all night talking about it.
Oh, no.
But, yeah, absolutely. I think you could, and as I said, some of the adaptations of Oliver Twist do take that tack of a much darker, grittier tone and portraying the realities of Victorian life. There is a book called London Labor and the London Poor, which was by a journalist in the Victorian era whose name I can't recall. I think it was Richard something. Sorry, audience, for not remembering Victorian journalist names. But this book really went in and examined the working conditions. This was, I think, just post-Dickens or a contemporary of Dickens. And there are some truly, like, horrifying, creepy, weird stuff that happened in the Victorian era because there were not laws and there were not movements to protect the rights of children, and very few to protect the rights of anyone who was not not only a white man but also a fairly wealthy or respectable white man. Like, you could easily fall into the most abject and horrible situations as almost anyone without means in Victorian society.
What a fun time to be alive.
Consider yourself.
And I mean, on the other side of this, there's also, like, I mean, this wasn't a Disney production, mm-hmm. but Disney does a ton of children's and family media that mm-hmm. on the surface has extremely dark themes. I'm not sure they've ever done, like, domestic violence victim who's eventually murdered. That seems dark even for them. But there are countless examples of this similar kind of thing
right.
where something that is would be incredibly difficult subject matter presented in one way is presented in a more obscured way or more digestible way for a younger
audience.
Well,
it's a classic sort of Disney method of the villain dies because they fall off a cliff or mm-hmm. something. Famously, like, this happens 100 times, but what I'm thinking of is Claude Frollo in Hunchback of Notre Dame, where he slips off the bell tower and falls into the mist to his death. And that's sort of your just desserts for being a villain in a family movie is uh-huh. you will not you better not climb anything because you will fall to your death.
Hunchback of Notre Dame is actually an excellent example for a very dark story that was adapted for children.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just all around. Oh, man. Okay. So we're getting close to wrap-up time. So I want to ask if there's any major things you want to hit before we get to lightning round, which I know is now completely catching you by surprise. But
One thing I'll touch on before we move on is when we're talking about Nancy's death and we're talking about I don't think this happens in the stage play because it's usually too hard. But Bill Sykes in the movie has a dog who follows him around everywhere. I believe his name is Bullseye because he's got like a little spot on his eye. And I hope I'm not thinking of the Target dog. I hope because they were the same breed in the movie. They were that that terrier breed with the pinched face. So mm-hmm. I could be wrong. But when he kills Nancy, his dog deserts him. And then the dog leads the crowd, like the mob, to Bill's location, which ultimately results in his death. So dog was on Nancy's side, which I think is weird, but also pretty cute.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That dog knew right from wrong.
Oh, he absolutely did. That dog did his prayers, went to Bible study. He was a very moral pup.
Wow.
Oh my God. Yeah, so I don't think I can think of anything else in particular. There's so much to talk about with Oliver and the minor characters, the major characters. There are all sorts of things that you might touch on. The fact that Fagin is a portrayal of a Jewish person in the Victorian era, which is both, you know, extremely problematic and in a certain way very interesting and significant because it's one of the few times that there was a Jewish main character mm-hmm. in a Victorian novel.
So in my readings of this, I read that character is pretty widely considered anti-Semitic in the original text, but that the musical adaptation pulled it pretty far away from that, partially by making Fagin much less of a villain and more of like a comic character.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And as I say, he was hanged in the novel, so that's pretty down on the character as a whole. It feels, I think, in a big way, very Merchant of Venice-y I will say what my takeaway from this is that I truly enjoy the character of Fagin. I truly enjoy in the musical his songs, his demeanor, the absolutely iconic portrayal of Fagin in the movie, after which all subsequent portrayals of that character are absolutely influenced by, if not directly modeled after, in this vaguely sort of effete kind of like his hands dancing around like Jack Sparrow, and the keen sense of the nods that Lionel Bart had to Eastern European and Jewish music in Fagin's songs. That sort of different scales than traditional Western music absolutely is a wonderful character. I will never say it's an offensive. I will never say that it's positive or good. But I will say that when I go to see Oliver, a great actor portraying Fagin like makes it for me. It's such a great part in the canon of musical theater. Comic parts, very much like Thénardier, where it's yes, it's problematic and offensive, but gosh, it's fun. It's also just fun music, fun stuff. And I'll put an interjection in here. Samantha Barks played Nancy in the 2014 revival of Oliver in the West End.
Yep.
And during that award ceremony, they brought back the actor who played Fagin in the movies to sing the song. And I think, first of all, I'm shocked he's still alive. The man is 98 years old.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And that was probably when I looked it up at the time. He could well be older now. I don't know if he's alive anymore. But, my God, like, he was there. He had a great time, it looked like he had a good time reviving this part. And also, I think that was where they announced that Samantha Bark would play Eponine in the Les Mis movie.
Oh, really?
Oh, it would have been older, though. It would have been 2011, I think, not 2014.
Well, she played Eponine on stage before the movie, so that might
have been. And she was in the 25th anniversary edition of Les Mis.
Yeah.
And then when they announced she was in a movie, it was while she was playing Nancy in the West End. So, sorry, listener, that was probably in 2011 or 2010.
Yeah. I wanted to comment on Samantha Barks being in that role as well, because she's really cornered the market of like, women who get murdered trying to help the main character.
Yeah, of like passed over, sad, but still ultimately like beautiful souls.
Has very good solos.
Yes.
The whole thing. I wanted to add about Fagin. It's also quite telling that when it came time to distribute the Tony Awards, which this won a lot of, the actor playing Fagin was nominated for Best Leading Actor, and the actor playing Oliver was Best Featured Actor.
That's
so Fagin is considered
funny.
The leading role, the leading male role of the musical.
That's very funny. I wonder in terms of screen time or stage time, as it were, if you can actually calculate that out, because there's almost never a time when Oliver's not on stage. So that is extraordinary, but it's one of those roles that grew and grew until like it almost defined the show. And I think you can look at the posters of the revival of Oliver, and you may recognize it, listeners, from the one that sort of looks like a squiggly tornado or something. And if you look at it, you realize this is Fagin's profile, done in like a sketchy kind of quick pencil-y way, with the hat and the O is one eye and the dot above the eye is another eye and the L is his nose. And I think that says a lot about how iconic Fagin has become as a character to this, that he far outstrips Oliver.
You know, Oliver gets the title, but Fagin is the character that we all love.
He gets the design, and that's what we remember, is that swirly, sketchy tornado.
I mean, honestly, it does make sense. It's like Oliver is, sure, the titular character, but mm-hmm. he's also kind of a blank slate. He's like the pure good child.
Right,
and things
right.
happen to him, and, you know, he asked for more food and whatever. Yes. But Fagin is fun. He has really good songs. He's interesting. He's weird. Like, yeah, he's going to capture more of the audience.
Yes. Well, this was actually going to go into something that I was going to talk about the other musical that I have been contemplating in my own English major ways, writing and such like, is that there is a difference between hero, main character, and protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas Oliver is absolutely the main character and quite possibly the hero of this tale, Nancy is the protagonist because she's the one who has this character arc where she rejects Bill and she rejects crime. And, you know, you see what that gets her. But I think that's absolutely fascinating to think about this from a structural perspective, if you are so inclined, listener, that Oliver doesn't – the point of Oliver is that he doesn't change. He's always good and pure. You can't touch him. But he is a catalyst for other characters around him to change.
Mm. Justice for Nancy, 2K19.
Nancy, 2012.
So it has gotten to the point where we have to wrap up. So let us get it into the lightning round.
All right.
Good luck. The first question is, what's your favorite song?
I think my favorite song would have to be Gotta Pick a Pocket or Two, which is one of Fagin's songs. There are so many great songs to choose from this musical, but and it's a dead heat between some of Nancy's and Fagin's, but I think Gotta Pick a Pocket or Two.
All right. And do you know what your favorite line is?
Any of the two that I mentioned, No She Won't Fagin, Yes She Will Fagin, or Shut Up and Drink Your Gin are both fantastic, memorable lines.
Great. Who's your favorite character?
I think it's no contest. It's got to be Nancy. She's a wonderful character with wonderful songs. If I ever do a gender-bent cabaret, I will definitely sing some of Nancy's songs. Yeah, she's, like I said, she's the protagonist. She's the one who's active, and she's the one who changes. And I absolutely envy anyone who gets to play that part.
My next question is, if you were going to play someone in a production of Oliver, who would you want to play?
I'm in my late 20s, so I think it would be Bill Sykes. That would obviously be the one that I'm most likely to play. Bill Sykes has a song that appears in the musical that was cut from the movie called My Name, where he's walking around talking about how he's like the toughest guy and everybody knows who he is even though they don't, quote, even know my name.
Okay.
So his reputation precedes him, basically, I guess. And Bill Sykes is a great part. Like, obviously, he's not a good person, but very often those characters can be the most fun to play. As I said, I will not get cast as Fagin until I'm well into my, 60s, probably. So that's probably the best I'm going to do right now.
All right. Who would you recommend go see the show?
I would absolutely recommend this show to anyone who maybe has a strong interest in musical theater but hasn't seen all the classics yet. Big time. Go see it or go see the movie because, as I said, the movie is a fantastic adaptation of this musical. And anyone who is interested in film, if you are thinking about film musicals, it is one of the great film musicals alongside, My Fair Lady and Grease and sort of those ones that came just before or just after it. Highly recommend it to anyone who's a student of the genre or genres that it appears in. Even though we talked about how it's not necessarily for families, I think one of the great things is that it's a musical you can keep coming back to and still enjoy and find more in. So if you saw it as a child and you haven't seen it since, I would say go back and see it again.
Nice. And then finally, if you could combine this musical with another one, what would you pick?
This is the tough one. This is the one with the other musical that I had the most difficult time preparing for or formulating an answer for. You know, this musical actually inspired Alain Boublil and Claude-Michel Schoenberg to write Les Miserables. They sort of saw the Victorian underworld aspect of it and were like, oh, well, we have one of those. Let's adapt that. With that said, I think it's a little too easy to combine it with Les Mis. What would be a good, interesting... You know what? We mentioned it. My Fair Lady would be a very interesting... Can you imagine, okay, Nancy doesn't die. She gets away, and she stops being a prostitute, and she becomes a flower girl, and then Professor Henry again sees her on the street and makes a bet with Colonel Pickering. I would watch that musical.
All right. Yeah, that's a pretty comprehensive through line, honestly.
There you go.
All right, that brings us to the end. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me.
And thank you all for listening. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Corner of the Sky. You can find us online at theincomparable.com/COTS or follow us on Twitter at COTS Podcast. If you'd like, you could also review us on Apple Podcast or give us a star on Overcast. See you next week.
Hello, audience. This is Colin. While Quinn's in the restroom, I'm going to sing selections from Oliver. And what I mean by selections is anything that I can remember right now from the beginning. Food, glorious food, what more can we wish for? I can't remember the rest of that. Let's go on. While we're in the mood, just thinking of growing fat, our stomachs are reeling, 1 minute of knowing that full-up feeling. Moving on. Where is love? Does it come from skies above? Is it underneath a willow tree that I've been dreaming of? Where is she who I close my eyes to see? Will I ever know the sweet hello that's meant for only me? Consider yourself at home. Consider yourself a part of the furniture. We've taken you so strong.